一个很简单的对 David 的 impression 啊。那个上去年的十二月，我们这边有一个slide show， 有一个人介绍那个他们去印度的那个印度之旅。那Thomas 和 David 都在里头。那有一张照片我非常非常的 impressed， 因为那张是early in the morning， 然后 David 在那边 doing walking meditation， 然后那个 before everyone else is in bed， 他走在草地上，那张照片是我看过的最 peaceful 的一张照片，所以非常非常的美的一张照片。那我觉得那张照片就是 David， 那非常 symbolic
啊，
那所以我们今天我们就请 David， 那之前请 David 帮我们带我们一起问去，然后结束的时候跟我们一起回想
OK。Stop three times? Okay. So three times out. OK， 我是还没准备在观音菩萨吗？观音菩萨三号七次，南无观世音菩萨。
English. I think that'll be easier. If you want me to translate, I can try. just to quickly introduce myself, I think here's how you introduce myself, introduce me. But I'm very happy to be here. I haven't been here, I've been here off and on over the last couple years, but I remember I was first here around 10 years ago, 1999, and this is where I first kind of started studying Buddhism with Alan, the young adult group, Julius as well, helping out with things. And I also remember going to the Tathagata Meditation Center in San Jose. I think one of the people here introduced me there as well. And they had a little Sunday school there. And I remember going there and the kids are like, "Mom, I don't want to be here. This is boring." And I remember the mom scolding the kid going, "When you're David's age, you can choose to leave." I was like 17 years old and he was like 8 years old. And so that kind of highlights actually in the area to be Buddhist and try to study Buddhism as a young person is actually very rare. There are very few young adult groups really studying Buddhism. And I was here with a study group here, and then there was that Sunday school. But past that, there really wasn't much at that time. And it's still the case. There's not very much. And so I guess I'm talking today's topic on Buddhism and young people, so I guess just my qualifications, I'm young and I'm into Buddhism, so that's my qualifications. But other than that, I think people here might have a lot more knowledge or a lot more experience. And so I'm just coming with a new, I guess, a perspective of a kind of growing up in modern society. In terms of my own interest in Buddhism and or religion, I think, just to be really brief, I started being interested in high school, end of high school, about 1999. And I studied both Christianity and Buddhism at the time. And as I said, there's not that many Buddhist young adult groups, but there's a lot of Christian young adult groups. So I think people who are, especially in the Asian American community, the Christian young adult groups are very strong. So I went to that for quite a while throughout my high school years, and even throughout through the beginning of college, I went to Christian fellowship. But I never really could take the leap of faith, so I ended up finding Buddhism more to my kind of understanding of things. So I, in addition to that, I actually read a lot about Buddhist teachings. A couple people who kind of I had an affinity with was Ajahn Sumedho, which I think people know from the Ajahn Chah tradition, Thai Forest. Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a Vietnamese kind of socially engaged monk. And also I was actually very inspired by a couple of monks of the Catholic tradition, which Thomas Merton, if people have any background in modern times, he's probably the most well-known Western monk in the Catholic tradition, Thomas Merton. And so I really was inspired by their lives as monastics and the Buddhist life itself. So I really wanted to kind of pursue that, to kind of pursue a kind of meaningful life, cultivating some kind of path, some kind of ideals. And so in college, I went with that kind of inclination of really trying to find my life path, a kind of a path to walk on. And I was very fortunate because in that time, it just so happened there was a young adult group called the Dharma and Buddhist Young Adults, or Dharma and Buddhist Youth at the time. And they planned one of their first retreats at the City of the Thousand Buddhas. And so that was my first kind of opportunity to study with young people Buddhism in a monastic environment with a Western teacher. At that time was Reverend Hung Shur. I think people know he is a monk in Berkeley. He was originally from Ohio. And so I went there, and I felt like I learned a lot. And as I came back, and I was really fortunate to have this young adult group to study with throughout my years. And now it's about 10 years later, and basically the group's thinking, well, we're kind of no longer young. I was the youngest one of the group, so they're like now 30s and 40s. A lot of them are married. And so they're like, we're not young anymore. So they're looking to try to pass it on to some other younger people at the moment. And so they're really thinking about how to bring Buddhism to the young adults the young adults in the area, young adults at large. Because I think for us, we feel really blessed because we felt Buddhism really helped us through this period of our lives and through addressing a lot of the issues that we had in life. And it's such a valuable thing, I think, because of wisdom that speaks. But it's the way it's presented oftentimes doesn't really connect with modern young people. And so I think that's a little bit of the topic today and what the group has been trying to do a little bit as a group. So I would want to start with it. A brief presentation. I actually did this for the, you didn't want to turn it off. I did this for this, when I actually graduated from college in 2004, 2005. I did physics and religious studies. And so after college, I went to the City of 10,000 Buddhas to be a kind of a resident volunteer there. And one of the first things that I did was I tried to explain young adults to the monks and nuns there. Mm-hmm. And people have been to City of 10,000 Buddhas. Young adults. Explain the Western mind frame and the young adults at college age, what are they thinking? So, because people have gone to Sitan Buddha, it's very traditional Chinese culture for sure. I mean, when I first got there, there was almost no one spoke English. I remember when I first went there with my mom for a bowing session, no one spoke English. They just bowed all the time, and I was like, what's going on? This doesn't make sense. So the first thing that I did, and then not just that, I mean, the other thing that I found out was that people would generally be really excited to try to teach the Dharma to some young person, but it would just so happen that what they said caused them to leave. and then the couple would be, oh, hashtag bin buko. Oh, his good roots are not enough. And how their conditions of the Dharma are not deep enough to understand it. And I think that's true, but I have to say causally, like the cause and effect was actually the kind of things you were saying to them doesn't really connect with their life, or cause them to actually have doubts around Buddhism even. And so one of the first things I tried to do was say, okay, so what are these young people, what are the Westerners coming with? So if you really want to teach Dharma, you're teaching the Dvaiti, you're teaching through the conditions. Mm-hmm. Right? So I put this together way back when I was in 2005. I just did a quick update for here. And this is really brief. I took out a lot of it because a lot of it is particularly for the Siddha 1000 Buddhas. But I think it gives a little bit of an outline. So in terms of the actual, just kind of a quick outline of this presentation, I was just going to go a little bit over the general viewpoints in college about the young adults, and then what in Buddhism attracts the youth in modern times. And so, so this is going to be very quick. At that time I tried with the Chinese, so there's Chinese up there. So I'm not going into too much depth for each of these because there's a lot to talk about each of these ideas. But generally speaking, in college or for the modern young adult experience, there's a couple of worldviews that are very prevalent. That the very least the young people have to, you can say, interact with if they're not in it themselves. So the first one is the materialistic culture. I think everybody is familiar with that. It's a kind of consumer society where we're kind of measured by the things we have, or we have all these advertisements telling us to buy things, or it comes out to being, kind of advice I would get was like, your worth in society is kind of determined by your actual amount you make, by the amount of financial kind of, because that's measured your productivity in society. It's a very economic way of seeing the world, and it's like the predominant world way that current modern society measures success, GDP, the way that we look at things now. And so for a lot of young people, although we might be, somewhat not happy with that viewpoint because we feel like there's a lot more to life, it's still very much a part of our life because we're in it. And we're basically, although we might not like it, we're in it. And we live in that structure. So that's one piece that's really prevalent. The other one is a relativism. I don't know if people know that word. Relativism is basically, it's like, everything is relative. In our generation, it's kind of unique. In your generation, for the older generation, as you guys kind of conform, I have to say that there is actually an ideal that people like have that a generation believe in as like a little bit like a standard. Our generation is actually pretty fluid. Everything is relative. First, we have all these different, morality is a little bit relative. Different cultures have different standards. So, we get along with everybody because, we don't hold each other to any kind of particular standards because things are relative. Mm-hmm. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a relativism. Again, people might not subscribe to that altogether, especially, say, the Christian. A lot of the young adults go to Christianity because they want to find some actual standard. Some kind of authority they can rely on. And so that's why there's a huge, people go into Christianity for the young people because they go, well, this, especially the Asian Americans, because they feel like this gives them a sense of a standards and guidelines to guide their life by. It's not just everything's relative. So, but for most young people, they're in this relativistic kind of environment. And they live in this. And we're very used to it. That's just how we are. The last one, I put it nihilism. I don't know if people are familiar with that word either. It's basically the idea that everything is kind of meaningless. Mm-hmm. Everything is kind of meaningless ultimately. Mm-hmm. And this is something that also for our generation, we're very used to. Mm-hmm. We don't find this too uncomfortable because our basic upbringing and our way of thinking is basically, ultimately there isn't really any meaning, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And we just kind of make the best of our life as we're on this planet and then we see what happens. That's the general, I don't know if you agree, but I think that maybe not everybody subscribes to it, but it's the general mindset, the kind of frames of thinking that frames a lot of what our kids think. So, and I think it also extends down to, say, even high school, for the kids in high school. We come in with, when we see it like this, we don't really like that, but generally speaking, deep down, a lot of people think that way. And I will read some kind of things, experiences, and have some kind of actual stories to kind of share that people kind of get little ideas about how these ideas work out in some people, young people's experiences. But you get a sense of these are the different actual structures of mind that young people come with to, especially when I'm talking about Buddhism now, come to Buddhism with, or the questions they bring to it. The last two are more around methodology or approach that we grew up with in America. So we grow up with an idea of knowing for yourself, kind of self-experience. There's not really an outside standard of experience. We are experienced ourselves. So even, for instance, people who are involved with education in our high schools or etc., there's the emphasis on learning for yourself. Like our mathematics even. They want the kids to figure out the math laws themselves or the physics laws themselves through experiments. I know in Taiwan a little bit, from what I hear, people actually memorize, you know, lots of things. And that's how they learn. But in America, the emphasis is actually on discovery of yourself. And so that's one thing. The other one is a self-reliance. On the positive side, sometimes it's pure independence. So this is oftentimes a little bit, kids become a little bit rebellious, because the independent mentality in America is very strong. It's like an ideal that we grow up with. We see on TV. We see like the tough cowboy, you know, the kind of ideal, the really tough individual, rugged individual. And so that's the kind of way we approach Buddhism with. So first three are kind of mindsets. The last three are just kind of ways of approach. I'm just giving as a kind of an outlook framework. So so actually, just to go back another step, for this presentation, it's going to go over the framework, and I'm going to try to go over the actual specifics next, after I go over the framework. And if you want to kind of connect it with the Buddhism, it's kind of like the Four Noble Truths. First one is suffering, right? The second one is the cause of suffering. So okay, this is just talking about the second, and I'm going to explain the first in a little bit. So the first, I'm going over the first two noble truths, I guess, for young people in modern times. So yeah, so basically these three lead to a lot of suffering, which I will go into later. But and then for a lot of kids, they look for a better answer. So what is there? And so it leads them to Buddhism. That's what brings them there. And so let me explain really quickly. This is like, I mean, like a 5-minute overview of Western culture, which isn't very thorough. If people have questions about it, we definitely go into depth about it. But in terms of suffering, on the picture on the left are actually the concentration camps during the Holocaust. And for sure, for kids growing up, we're exposed to stuff, seeing that the level of human suffering and misery that humanity has produced. That's very, and it's something that we are ingrained, I mean, we're taught that happened. But to go back a step, I wrote out a really quick kind of progression. So basically, if people follow Western history, at one point there was a faith in science, a faith in technology, a faith in economy. That's the kind they call it modernity. And I think a lot of, when I talk to my dad or talk to my mom, it seems like, and people can disagree, that this was a little bit filled with the mindset of the Asian parents who came over to America. There is a kind of idealism of science being an answer to humanity's problems. The science is an ideal in itself to study, and if you study it, you'll create knowledge, and maybe one day science will save us, or science will find a great solution for us. So for most kids, though, because we've learned actually this Western history, we learned that at one point what actually happened was there was World War II, where all that science, all that progress, all that knowledge was used for great human destruction. And that caused, they call it postmodernity in the Western thought. And there's a huge amount of disillusionment with society, where basically people thought, there is no meaning. What is the meaning? I mean, we ended up like this. There is no meaning. Science kind of debunked Christianity a little bit, you know, science and religion. And then when people put their faith in science, and progress and industrialism, it ended up in the Holocaust and like World War II and this huge massive suffering. And so people generally began to feel like there's no meaning in life. Yeah, making sense, okay. And so that kind of leads to, I mean, what I just said before, it kind of leads to the mindsets, particularly nihilism, which is a sense of there's no meaning in life. And a lot of the philosophers of the time, like I said, the existentialist philosophers, basically tried to deal with this feeling of no meaning, of trying to say, okay, we just then create the meaning for ourselves, although this meaning in life doesn't make any sense. And not just that, so our generation, though, live in a, they call it postmodern society, Sorry, I don't want to confuse people. The reason is because we're actually very used to this feeling there's no meaning in life. It doesn't bother us at all. We're just like, okay, there's no meaning. So what's the big deal? I mean, that's how we're the postmoderns, we're actually disturbed by this. We live in a society where we're just like, this is just the baseline of life, where we start from. So I'm just explaining the overall narrative. Some more areas of suffering in the actual religion, on the picture on the left is still Holocaust. But basically those are all the shoes of a lot of the camp prisoners at the time. So you can just see the massive amount of suffering, I mean, in the actual Holocaust. So the question in Christianity and Judaism was they asked this question themselves, how could God let this happen? How could God let something so horrendous happen to us? And for secular society, the general answer was, there is no God. There's no God. And that's really, you know, a little bit scary for the Western world where religion was Christianity and the Judeo-Christian, the Abrahamic religion as their structure. And so this is where another area of suffering comes from, where there's this kind of tension. And I actually remember going there with my family, I don't know when. When was it? 1996 or 7 or something. And I just wrote this was in my journal at the time. I remember writing it. I remember visiting Auschwitz. That left a deep impression on my heart. Humans can be so cruel. But religious stories abounded there. On one of the cells, there was a simple scratched out image of Jesus, which brought tears to my eyes. I was constantly reciting Psalm 23. People know the Bible, there's Psalm 23. Mm-hmm. Psalms. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me, your staff and rod, they protect me. I left Auschwitz feeling uplifted by the story of selflessness I heard. There seem to be two options when faced with this horror. One is despair, but the other is a transcendence of suffering. I remember writing this, actually one of the monks in Abayagiri, one of the Thai fortresses, he said that actually this was the case. People meet suffering, and basically you have two choices at that point. You either go into despair, or go down, or you look for a solution. So there's, I mean, I didn't think about that at the time, but that was my feeling at the time. So people then look for an answer, for young people who are coming to Buddhism, right? And materialism, they don't see an end to it. If you just look at it, you go, well, you get more and more stuff, and then you die. And then you have all the world's resources. I mean, that doesn't seem like any actual way to find a meaningful existence. Right? The next one is pursuing science as my, pursuing knowledge as my meaning in life. You go, well, that doesn't seem right. And we ended up with science and technology being used by the war machine and the machine, the defense industry, or the, and then it causes massive suffering. I'm going to devote myself to that, or is run by corporate. I mean, so we go, no, there's no, that's not really an answer that I find meaningful. And then in Western religion, a lot of people don't believe in that construct anymore. And so what happens is that a lot of young people look to the East. They look to Buddhism. They look to Taoism. They look to Confucius. I mean, not Confucius, but they look to Buddhism. Actually, they look to Buddhism more than they look to any other religions, because Buddhism actually brings, like even more than Hinduism, because Buddhism actually has a system of thought that, say, Hinduism doesn't have. Hinduism is actually a collection of religions. Taoism doesn't really have a system of thought either. It's actually a collection of Taoist practices that's very varied. So Buddhism is actually something a lot of young people look to right now in college for solutions for some of these questions. And so when I use the bottom two, is these are what their methodologies that they use to go about their spiritual search, looking for an answer. So, knowing for yourself, 自己正, self-reliant independence, 靠自己独立, right? So first one, a scientific mindset, a self-reliance. In schools, we're encouraged to be independent thinkers. You know, oftentimes in Western classrooms, we hear it from teachers, there are no stupid questions. If you ask a question, somebody else has that question, so you should ask that question. Right? But when I asked to talk to my Asian friend, I had one really good friend who was from a kind of rural area in Malaysia, and she was saying how actually she will, if she asked a question, she felt bad because she felt she was holding up the classroom. But that's actually, I mean, some people nodded in the back. I mean, that's actually a thought in Asian culture. Or Western kid growing up, we actually even have that thought. I have a question, I should ask my question. You know? That's the kind of culture we're brought up in. A very independent thing. The other one is that we want to test everything. We ask questions. We don't just believe what we're told. We ask why. And this is something I always get in conflict with at the monastery at CDD sometimes, even with my parents sometimes, is I always like to ask why. I mean, so wait, they're like, so why are we doing this? And they go, why don't you just listen to me? I'm your superior, or I'm your parent. I mean, so. Narrative, my mom told me this, so therefore, you know. So the attraction of Buddhism is that it seems to fit into this approach, and how it's presented to the Western, how it fits into that approach. Mm-hmm. Right, okay. So this is why Buddhism is attracted to the younger people. This is one area, which is, I don't know if people know the Kalama Sutta. Have people heard of that? The Kalama Sutta? Okay, so this is a very popular Buddhist text because it talks exactly on this point. Okay, so let me give a quick Kalama Sutra. What they have with John. Yeah. So the Kalama Sutra is basically a text. I'm going to give you a little background. So the Buddha went to this place, these people called the Kalamas. And these people have all these different religious teachers come in from different religious teachers, and they would teach. And so this is actually the sutra, what it says. The Kalamas ask the Blessed One, that's the Buddha. There are some monks and Brahmins. Brahmins were the religious teachers of the time in India. Bola Manjiao, the Brahmin. Yeah. So, Venerable Sir, who visits, they say, Brahmin, Venerable Sir, who visits Kesaputa, where they are. They expound and explain only their own doctrines. The doctrines of others they despise, revile, and pull to pieces. Some other monks and Brahmins too, Venerable Sir, come to Kesaputa. They also expound and explain only their own doctrine. The doctrine of others they despise, revile, and pull to pieces. Venerable Sir, there is doubt, there is uncertainty in us concerning them. Which of these reverend monks and Brahmins spoke the truth and which spoke falsehood? Mm-hmm. Right, so they asked the Buddha, so, I mean, who is right, who is wrong? Right? So what's the Buddha's response? The Buddha said, it is proper for you, Kalama, to doubt, to be uncertain. Uncertainty has arisen in you about what is doubtful. Come, Kalamas, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon rumor, nor upon what is in a scripture, nor upon surmise, nor upon an axiom, that's a truth, nor upon a specious, that is false reasoning, nor upon a bias towards a notion that has been pondered over, nor upon another seeming ability, nor upon the consideration, this monk is my teacher, or our teacher. Kalamas, when you yourselves know, these things are bad, these things are blamable, these things are censured by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to harm and ill, abandon them. Mm-hmm. Come, Kalamas, do not go upon what has been, wait, no. So he goes through the same list, and he says, so only when you yourself know these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness. Enter on and abide in them. So this is a very interesting teaching for a Western modern person, if you think about it, right? Because it addresses an issue, which is how do you look at religious authority? How do you find a path? And it seems very scientific. It's a little bit of a setup. You see, the Kalamas asked him, expect the Buddha to say what? I'm right, they're all wrong. Follow my doctrine. You know? But his response was, no, actually, your doubtful is good. You're doubting the right thing. You should know for yourself what's right and what's wrong. And so for the young people now, where our experience is, you know, we want to know everything for ourselves, this kind of understanding is very attractive. Right? So that's the Kalama Sutra. And so the Kalama's response is this, marvelous Venerable Sir, as if, Venerable Sir, a person were to turn face upwards what is upside down, or to uncover the concealed, or to point the way to one who is lost, or to carry a lamp in the darkness, thinking, those who have eyes will see visible objects. So has the Dharma been set forth in many ways by the Blessed One. We, Venerable Sir, go to the Blessed One for refuge, to the Dhamma for refuge, and to the community of bhikshus for refuge. Venerable Sir, may the Blessed One regard us as lay followers who have gone for refuge for life from today. So they're very happy. Okay, so what attracted the youth to Buddhism? So number one, I showed basically how it's a kind of a scientific methodology that you can know for yourself. The other one is a kind of independence, relying on yourself. So meditation is very attractive for young people nowadays because it's based on your own experience, right? You don't have to believe in a set of doctrines to meditate and look at your mind and see that you have these thoughts and you have these desires and have these emotions. The other one is that it's very much you rely on yourself. You don't have to go out and believe in a structure of thought or believe in salvation by, you know, in Christianity it's, you know, believe in Jesus Christ as your Savior so then He died for your sin. You don't have to do that. You can look at yourself and you can work through your own karmic processes. So that's another really attractive quality of Buddhism for young people. And so what the quote I think in Buddhism is, all have the Buddha nature, all can become Buddhas. I mean, that's very kind of a universal, democratic kind of statement. That's very attractive for the modern mind. So this is the last slide I have. Yeah. So this is just a quick kind of last piece. Basically saying, we ask questions, and so for Buddhism, from the actual testing, the actual trying out of the actual practices, from there we gain confidence and we gain faith in the tradition in Buddhism. It's not like we come in and we all of a sudden believe in Buddhism and then we follow it. It's kind of like a step by step. We try it out, we practice it, we think it's actually helpful, and then step by step we're led into the Dharma. That's kind of the actual process of our experiences into Buddhism. So that's what I have. I mean, if anybody asks me one or two questions just about this one piece, I was actually going to be to read the next. I was actually going to go into the actual experience of young people. But I wanted to ask if people maybe have a little question or two if what I said didn't make sense in any part of it when I saw how this slides up. Anything that didn't make sense? Question?
Another question.
Yeah.
So one of the things I hear like very frequently from like young like college age people is like Buddhism isn't a religion, it's a philosophy.
Yeah.
And so I hear that quote very, very often. And that is maybe perhaps a little bit of a misunderstanding. But it makes it attractive to people who are generally like skeptical of like Western religions, mm-hmm. or, you know, believe in God. So when people find that statement to, like, even if they don't practice or believe in Buddhism, they feel positive.
Yeah.
Because of that.
Yeah.
So what do you think of?
Well, I completely agree, and I think that actually connects completely with what we were just talking about. I mean, it kind of highlights that. My first question you usually ask them that got to me is kind of ask them what their definition of religion is. What the definition of religion might be God. It has to have God in it. It has to be something telling you that you believe in it. There's blind faith attached to religion. I mean, there's a dogmatism that's attached to religion. There's these rituals that are attached to religion. So then they say philosophy is a way of life, a way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And so that's a love of philosophy, a love of wisdom. I mean, that's what philosophy. So then they have that. So for me, what happens usually is the idea of religion is so complicated that if you ask a person what does it really mean by religion, you actually have a really good sense of where they're coming from. So they actually answer the question. So what I'm saying is that oftentimes people's experience with religion is very negative. I mean, their experience of religion is just this. They come, the religious teachers come, they expound their own doctrines, they revile and pull other people's doctrines,
yeah.
And say, my way is the right way, the way, the truth, and the only way, and you follow me, or there's no other way. I mean, I can quote you a lot of things. So people, that's what they attach to the idea of religion. And so they come to Buddhism, well, Buddhism doesn't do this, that's why I think it's not a religion.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nihilism.
How
do you pronounce nihilism?
Nihilism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it very close to
atheism? No.
No.
It's a completely different concept. Atheism means you do not believe in a God. I mean, in the West, oftentimes atheism and nihilism are similar because in the West, meaning is only, I mean, you only have meaning through God. So therefore, if you don't believe in God, therefore you're nihilistic. You don't have any meaning in your life. There's no ultimate meaning. But, see, Buddhism is is a little bit atheism in the sense that they don't believe, I mean, you can't really say the Buddhist atheist or not, but it doesn't believe in a Judeo-Christian God at least. But at the same time, it's not nihilistic. I mean, the Buddha said it's not, the Buddha said it's not existentialism, I mean, it's eternalism, it's not nihilism, you know, it's not either of those, what Buddha taught. It's not a middle way.
But I thought one aspect of atheism is that maybe nothing has consequences. Then in that sense, it's similar to nihilism.
Well, no, atheists don't believe there's no consequences. Yeah, they don't believe. I mean, a lot of very moral atheists, there's a lot of very strong atheists who are very moral. They're like secular humanists. They're secular humanists. They believe that, you know, you couldn't find goodness within the human existence. This humanity itself has enough rules to be as a person, to be a good person. You don't need God. Yeah.
When you go to talk to youth groups,
yeah,
they already believe life is suffering, especially for young people.
I'll answer that next.
Okay.
I'll answer that next.
I'm not young anymore, I'm just curious how young people define suffering.
Okay.
Do they really see it that way?
Do they really see it that way? Okay. You can just ask it.
Pardon?
Depends who's asking.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, if there's not any particular question, I'm going to go to the actual. The next thing I want you to want to read is, to turn off, push it twice. Okay. Is a newsletter put out by Las Gatas High School. People know Las Gatas High School. It's actually in the Saratoga Union. I mean, my mom's actually on the school board.
That's how you got it.
That's how I got the subscription, because my mom's on the school board. They sent it to her, and I said, "Wow, this is really interesting that young people are thinking this. I mean, they're writing about it so strongly. I mean, they're writing it so raw. I mean, it's a very raw document. And so, I was just going to read a couple, just so people have a sense. I won't say this is the only experience of young people. Young people are very happy, but these are actually very strongly negative most of the time. But I want to read, so you ask the question, are young people suffering? If you were asking that question, they might not actually say they're suffering, because you're asking the question. But if you actually talk with each other, we're going through massive suffering. I mean, young people, the complexity of a young person's life now growing up in America as a young person is much more complicated than growing up in Taiwan.
Oh, yeah.
30, 40 years ago.
Okay.
I mean, I remember talking with them. I mean, when I did this with the nuns at CDP, they're like, "Wow, do young people think all this stuff?" I'm like, "Yeah." They're like, "All I thought about was going to a good college." But even my mom told me that, you know, if I want to get a good boyfriend, I have to go to college. And that's what everybody told me. I was like, "Yeah, our society, I mean, our growing up is not like our reality is not like that." And so it's a very different. So what this is a newsletter put up by the Las Gatas High School students, where they actually go around and they have a topic for the month, and the students anonymously submit articles or little stories. And so what they entitled it is called Reality Check, as you know, the newsletter. Okay, so their hope is to bring some kind of open communication so parents know what the young adult experience is in high school. So I'll read two or three of them. So here's the first one. This one's on love, which I think Buddhism talks about a lot as well. Okay, so people interested in that, afterwards there's a whole bunch of people want to look at a couple and you can see what the other people are thinking. Okay, so the first one. Honestly, I have no idea where to begin on the topic of love. I admit that I love my family and their love and support keeps me going, so I am not one of those kids that is deprived of love in that aspect. However, as a teenager, that is not always the love that I want at the moment. Let's face it, I have had horrible experiences with love. For me, it took one horrible relationship to ruin the following relationships. I trusted my girl so much that I let her take advantage of that and wind up breaking my heart. Yeah, people say trust is the key. Okay, he says BS in explicit. I gave someone my trust, and where did that get me? Depressed and feeling like I was in the gutter for good this time.
Oh.
From then on, I began to be the one breaking the hearts. I would get with girls to have a good time, but they didn't know that. I would let my relations get to a point where they would trust me and would end up being the jerk that cheated or the jerk that suddenly ended or the jerk that simply... ended it for the jerk simply a date to coronate, or simply a date to a party, a coronation. English is so good. I have since realized that just because I was victimized does not give me reason to become the victimizer. Those poor girls. I know how I felt. Why would I want to do it to everyone else? I hope that by some minuscule chance, a girl that I hurt will read this and accept my apology. And maybe even the girl who hurt me will see how she affected my life. My goal for my life last year at high school is to make others know how much I love them. Love is now my driving force. This is a relatively positive one. I mean, I can read you. It actually goes into, I mean, actual, like, really intimate sexual relations, which I'm not reading in this one, but you read it and you'll find, and they're like, people are like raped, people are like losing their virginity and then very unhappy about it, and all the suffering that goes along with that. And so, that's, I mean, that's part of the experience. That you're not, doesn't mean that everybody's going through that, but that means that's part of the experience that young people are at least interact with. I mean, at least they have a couple of friends they know who have that experience. For what I found for most of the younger, older, I mean, the parent generation, for instance, the Asian background, first generation, they actually usually are surprised that kids even think this way at all. I'm like, yeah, that's our experience. That's our experience. So, another one I had was, this was actually, their topic on this one was marijuana. Okay. So, when I was in middle school, I never thought I would want to smoke or do it. But once you try it and get over the fear of being caught, you like it. I remember that day I decided I wanted to do it, my friend and I were chilling out, and I said, have you ever tried weed? And he told me, yeah, dude, I kind of had done it a lot. I was totally shocked. It was nuts. I had no idea that my best friend had done this before and that I didn't even know about it. This was the summer before my sophomore year, and that was when I decided I wanted to try. The first night I did it, I got really high, and they say it takes a lot for the first time you do it, but it worked for me. I liked the feeling. I was normally a stressed out person, and it made me so calm and relaxed that nothing that was going on in my life which caused me stress mattered. I mean, if you've ever seen Pineapple Express, you know weed makes everything better. Music, movies, food, even deep conversations get so much better. I smoke a lot now. Not crazy like an addict, but when the opportunity comes up, I'll do it. People just need to understand that Las Gatas, most people smoke, so you're not weird for wanting to try. If you're afraid of being getting addicted, you're an idiot. You won't. You can stop whenever you want it. Want to. It's, and it's okay. So if you want to, try it. I mean, that's a somewhat neutral one, too. I mean, you can read it. Some people have very negative experiences. Some people have positive experiences. It's a, there's a range. So I'm just trying to give it just a sense. So that's another experience. One more. One more is... Okay. Oh, this is on reputation. This one, I don't know, I picked a relatively good one. I tried to pick all the good ones. So this one is actually a very positive one, which I'm happy to read. Of all the ones, this is one of the nine. So my reputation is pretty much good. I like the way people think about me because I act like myself. I'm not a fake, nor have I ever given anyone the impression that I am. I am known as an athletic scholar with a strong work ethic and in about everything I participate in. I've had some bad times in my life too, but that has not stained my reputation. I like who I am, and I like what I do. I am old enough to make my own decisions in life. I choose what I feel is best for me, not for what other people feel is best. If people like it, then great. If they don't, then that's their loss. I would rather people just appreciate me, instead of being a fake just to fit in. So that was a little bit, that's actually a positive one. And I won't read, I mean, okay, I'll read one, since you asked the suffering one, I think, on the same note as on the reputation one? Okay, so there's another one. Reputation is something that's not funny to many people, especially in high school. Last year, I was considered one of the school sluts. Guys would only talk to me by messaging me on MySpace saying, well, I have seen you around school and, okay, explicit, you're really pretty, but I was just too scared to talk to you about in person. Would you send me some nudes, or some naked picture of yourself, or hang out sometime? But to me, being immature and stupid, I would hang out or hook up with the popular guy, but the guy would use me and forget about me the next day by ignoring my text messaging. But last year, I wasn't a slut and only did stuff with a couple of guys, but I really, really liked them, not knowing they would use me. I got my heart broken and people today still call me a slut, even though I haven't done anything for a whole year. I have tried to get my reputation back, but it isn't possible to get it back. I have been trying hard, and I'm dating a guy now who I have been best friends with, and he changed me from doing stuff with guys into a person that only does stuff with that special someone. Reputation can screw up high school for some people, and maybe even when they are out of high school, even out of high school. I get teased a lot about the stuff I did, and people today still talk bad behind my back. But I don't care because it wouldn't make me who I am today with all the great fans I have. My advice is to all that are reading this is just don't do things with guys unless they really care about you because there's no point to doing anything.
That's true, though.
That's true. Yeah. Some of those are relatively positive. I mean, some of them are. Yeah. So in terms of what I want to read these was that actually, for me, this is actually love as a kind of a young adult experience. It's very tumultuous. It's a very kind of up and down. I mean, Julia, you kind of, if you say, anything I say is off from your experience, you can definitely chime in.
Yeah.
You can definitely chime in also Buddhist. So, I would say that it's very tumultuous. And I think that for me, the kind of piece that kind of puts a stamp on it, that how they titled the actual newsletter, they call it Reality Check.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of the reality of these kids.
Mm-hmm.
And what I feel concerned about more than actually what's happening, and also from my own experience, is that, I mean, if you were to ask a lot of the young, like, high school age, these kids, so have you ever met a person you really admire that you, in the future, might want to be like in the future, that you interact with on a daily or at least on a weekly basis? Can you list anybody? And I don't know if Julie, have you ever had, would you be able to list anybody? I don't know how many kids would actually be able to say they know somebody. They really sincerely think is a really good person that they would really want to emulate, that they interact with on a daily basis. I mean, really on a daily basis, because what happens is oftentimes the person is like a movie star or like a fictional hero on a movie.
Mm.
And so what that is, it's not real. The relationship is not a real relationship. It's not like something you actually interact with somebody. It's like a projection of an ideal of like a movie
idol.
Or something, an idol. Yeah. That you don't actually have a direct connection with.
Right.
So my feeling though was that I actually was really fortunate in high school because I actually had a really, I mean, he's not here, but his dad's not here, but I actually just went home and we had a lunch together. And he was like somebody who's kind of like that person who just talked at the very end, who's like the athletic scholar who worked really hard, who's really funny. And so this other, I don't know, our lunch conversation, he had like kind of a funny moment. He said like, you know, I met all these bullies, and over time they were all bullies. I mean, they're not bullies, they all work out not being bullied. And I made the comment to him, I was like, you know why they stopped becoming bullies? It was because of you. He was actually the person, just because of how he was able to be a really cool and fun person without bullying, and he knew all the nerds as well, because he was really nerdy, kind of, he was really smart.
Right.
He actually created a space where all these bullies stopped being bullies. That was because he's like, huh? I never realized that. I just realized that bullies were all cool. I mean, they're all actually good people. And I'm like, yeah, because he actually played that role of linking something. And so for myself, I actually felt really fortunate because I actually had him largely as a person that I felt was a really good person that I could emulate or be around. And I think for young people, that's really valuable. If you want to take for actually a young person experience. So that's the one piece of it. Okay. I don't have any questions about that piece. I just have more stuff. So. A couple different sections of this.
I just wanted to say Los Gatos is still a very good school.
It is. I mean, that's the thing. That's the actual piece of it is that Los Gatos and Central High School are actually really good schools. So you can imagine going to somewhere where there's actually like gang warfare going. I mean, like actual physical violence going on.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually in a place that's actually very peaceful. So it's a little bit of a mark saying, hey, this is a kind of experience that's actually on the top notch schools. I mean, they're good schools in America.
But keep in mind, I think
it's also a small percentage.
It's a small percentage. Actually, David and I talk about it. You know, I think the reality check. I think they are people with positive minds, but seems like it's so rare in the writings. Yeah.
Yeah. If I was to give some feedback, I would say, can you maybe pick a couple topics that are a little bit more positive, and make you kids think about those kind of topics that are maybe part of, like, you know, something like gratitude towards parents or something. I mean, how many people would write an article?
Nobody would write it.
I mean, you know, it's a different publication.
When you say a good school, Genghai in Palo Alto is a good school.
Yeah.
And look at that, within 6 months, 5 suicides.
Yeah.
We are confused.
Yeah. And they probably the kids they will never put in words, write and submit to like a
yeah.
Yet.
Well,
they don't express themselves. Yeah.
They won't express themselves. Not just that. So I was saying when Rita I was asking about when they ask the kid that they're suffering, they probably would say no.
Yeah.
Why would they tell you?
Why would I tell my parents?
I didn't know my son was so unhappy.
Yeah, they're like, well, why would I tell my parents? I mean, most kids wouldn't tell their parents because they try to project a kind of a happy exterior to the parents because it gets them in a lot less trouble. Otherwise, their parents keep nagging them. I mean, their parents keep like looking into my life. I mean, why would I want to actually tell them like what's going on? I mean, I'm doing my own stuff. I'm being independent.
See, actually, that was exactly that. Question there.
Yeah.
I asked the question, it's an opening question. The real question I want to ask is after this is okay, so in terms of looking at suffering,
yeah.
Kids have their own way to look at their suffering
yeah.
Versus parents or teachers and grown ups around them.
Yes.
And so that gap becomes a challenge that who can address the meaning of suffering or
yeah.
The definition of suffering, you name it.
Yeah.
And how to target the suffering to really can attract their mind. To do something
yeah,
to
yeah.
Transform the suffering of emotion to something more positive.
Like, yeah, so, I mean, so it actually makes, I mean, that's a good transition to the actual last section I have, which is the actual, that actual idea is how do you actually bring some kind of, so that's why I think for the young, I mean, for when we do the young adult group, is that we feel like having Buddhism is really helpful because it gives a lot of guidelines for how you get rid of your, get out of your suffering. And that's the whole basis of the Four Noble Truths, that you have suffering, you figure out the cause of it, and then you end it, and you have a way to do it.
Right.
And so, I mean, so what I just gave on the presentation was, I mean, I tried to answer a couple questions, because I was talking to different people. One was, if a young person approaches, say, somebody, this is at the monastery, comes to the monastery, and they question about Buddhism, how do you answer that? So that was one of the... That kind of presentation I just gave
mm-hmm.
was partly that.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of just some kind of, I'll just give you a sense of the actual, like a talk that we give in the monastery.
Mm-hmm.
So these are young people who come to the monastery to actually come for a Guanyin recitation session. And the evening we have talks. And so here's one way to approach it. So this is by a high school teacher, he's a retired high school teacher in Berkeley. Who actually really can speak to the young adult mind just because it's, I mean, that's his affinity. He's kind of really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of hippie generation.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a Westerner and kind of, he's actually still kind of hippie-ish in his kind of way of talking.
Yeah.
And so he's kind of cool.
Very appealing.
So very appealing and very sharp. And so he's kind of, so as a teacher, because I often tell my students there are two ways to get fabulously wealthy. One way is to earn a lot of money. But for that, you have to work really, really hard. And even then, you still might not succeed. The other way is to become wealthy to lessen your desire. If you can lessen your desire to zero, then you're absolutely, fabulously, enlightened wealthy. Wealth is the ability to buy the things you want.
Well,
if you do not have any material desire, then you're ready to have the game.
Yeah.
Obviously, to get from where we are currently to zero desire takes time. There are gradations. In fact, there's an algebraic formula that applies to everyone in this world. I have this much, I want that, it will cost this much, for which I had to work this much and sacrifice this much free time, and so on. This calculation is yet another way of looking at karma. The degree to which our cultivation can bring down our desire is the degree to which we have to be engaged in the web. When we say the web, we were talking before about the web of desire.
Yeah.
The web of desire. Doesn't say. Yeah. Our desires are the karmic structures in which we are confined. And our cultivation provides a means of freeing ourselves from them. So he says, how to detach yourself from this web? The consequences of every one of your little actions every day are called your life. When you cultivate, you get to open up a little space where you have more wisdom and patience. You can use that patience to look carefully at what you are doing and hopefully choose a different future for yourself than the one that's already in motion.
Mm-hmm.
The City of 10,000 Buddhas is an interesting place to witness these dynamics in action. People who live or work here have a limited desire and lead a Spartan or austere life. They have simple jobs, a place to live, and their basic needs met. However, if you compare this place to the outside world of 6 or 7 billion people, however, more than 4 billion would think they are fabulously rich to be here. As tough as you may think living here at the 6,000 Buddhists is, there are 4 billion people in this world who would gladly live here and think they are wealthy. Within the context of the larger world, the lifestyle here is not even Spartan. By your own standards, if you can lessen your desire enough to be able to live here, then you have freed yourself tremendously from the entire dynamics of the world outside. That is a great amount of freedom that you could gain that you would otherwise not recognize. However, if you decide to go out and try to touch a bit of the outside world, for example, buying a small house, you will be caught in the entire web. If you're aware of this trade-off and still choose to get into whatever it is that you're getting yourself into, then you should not have any complaints. This is ultimately what wisdom is the ability to understand the cause and effect of your actions and desires and seeing through something enough to either decide not to do it, or if you choose to, then to take full and complete responsibility for the outcome. This is not about being a good or bad person. This is just the reality of your life. You do not have any other choice but to live out the life you create for yourself.
Great.
So that's kind of like dharma. That's kind of like the dharma for. And so, I mean, this is one, I mean, there's a huge section on listening, like how you actually listen to people without bringing right the discrimination in your mind, to actually really listen to actually how people think, to actually have a real genuine relationship. So he did a little section on parents at the end of. So, interaction with your parents. You have to look at your interaction with your parents as one of the greatest practices you can engage in. This is a lifelong project, and it is an important source of wisdom in understanding yourself. Your relation with them is fundamental to your identity on the psychological level. Much of the hidden dynamics of your personality that have a huge impact on you, including the feelings you have about yourself, originate from your interaction with your parents from a very young age. In order for you to make any progress in your cultivation, it is essential that you completely understand and penetrate all the elements of that interaction. Your relationship with them, how much you owe them, and how have you taken from them, and how much of the person you are is due to your interaction with them. Unresolved elements will probably affect not just your cultivation, but also your life in the more general sense. So Nate talks about how you go about interacting with your parents and listening.
This is to the young adult.
And this is what we recently published just as a talk. I mean, just kind of a series of talks. So I'm thinking.
Anyone would be interested in the booklet?
Yeah, I brought a couple. I brought a couple if people want to read it. So
one of the more important question is, did he write the other part?
Which part?
The reader for the parents.
I mean, his parents actually come and talk to him a lot, but if we want, we could. I mean, he probably could think about it.
And he's a great speaker.
He's really, I mean, I work with him all the time right now.
I think it's great to understand how he's teaching the young adults.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't be even better if he can also teach the parents.
We could. We could kind of think that through. I don't think he actually thought through how to parent a young adult in the modern. I mean, in for this structure. See, there's actually with the next topic. That's 3 days. So that next one was actually, so that was one of these people come to the monastery, what do? The other one is, how do you teach Buddhism to your kids? That was nothing that my dad said that many people are interested in. How do you teach the kids? So, I have to say, how I understand it, and maybe other people can chime in, because I know I've never been a parent, but from looking at the kids, I see that there's maybe 3 or 4 different phases. So, say under 5 years old, 5 to 12 years old roughly, 12 to 18 years old, 18 to 25, I mean, there's these different ranges of young people.
Yeah.
And the way you interact with each generation is different. So, the thing I found out for under 5 is that I realized under 5, they pretty much believe everything they see and hear. I was amazed because I was a little bit of a bad brother when I was talking to my little brother, who was 6.5 years younger than me, and I kind of was playing with him, and I said, "Hey, you know, I stole all of your power. Now you're going to die." He was like 4 years old. Okay, he breaks out completely crying. He's like crying. My mom runs in the room and starts scolding. "What did you do, David?" I'm like, "I didn't touch him." And they were like crying, like, "Oh, you stole all my power." And I'm like, "What do you mean?" I mean, I was like, "What's this kind of elaborate thing?" Like, "Shh, I gave up all your power. You're fine. You're fine. Stop crying."
No, you never told me that.
I remember coming out and I'm like, "Wow, that was really weird." But he was like, "Believe me, like, completely." At that age, and I realized, and I reflected on my own experience, that actually before that, like 4 or 5, you actually pretty much believe whatever you're told.
Which, psychology is a census.
Yeah. I mean, if you have people with psychology, people also real. I mean, they study psychology, study psychology, they also type data when you actually study. And so what that means, though, for me, in terms of parenting, is that that age before that is really important, what you say and what they see and what they hear. And it's scary for me to see that a lot of kids are just watching TV.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, that becomes their actual reality of what, I mean, not just Barney, I mean, there's other stuff that they come to the internet. I mean, the actual things that young people are actually exposed to at that age where they go into their deep subconscious as actual reality.
Yeah.
So, that age, if kids, if parents are still at that age, if they're kids, I mean, I'll say that that's really important to look at carefully. The next kind of phase is from 5 to 12. And this phase, I think, is they're kind of just they're creating some kind of ability to kind of think on their own of it, and they're like elementary. And this age, they're also listening to their parents.
Mm-hmm.
They actually look. We look up to our parents at this. I mean, see, I don't know. But generally speaking, we look up to our parents at that age range still. In elementary school, we look up to our parents to be like our protector. We go for guidance. We want to spend time with. We like their attention. 12. And so that's a time to really have a lot of interaction with them, to kind of understand how they think, that they understand how you think, to actually have that close relationship built. Because the next phase, 12 to 18,
forget it.
Exactly. It's no longer, that's no longer where our focus is. It's not like we really, at that age, we have that moment where we realize our parents aren't perfect. They're actually really hypocritical.
Yeah.
And they're really inconvenient and kind of uncomfortable to be around. And we want to be independent. On our own, be on our own. And so at that age, it's mostly peers.
It's all about peers, yeah.
What our friends are doing, what they're telling us to do. We look for guidance and support from them.
Right.
And so I'll say for a parent, at that age, it's really hard. I mean, if your kid's already 12 years old, and they're completely not listening to you, and they're going off to do that, at that point, to do anything is almost really hard because they won't listen to you anymore at that age. So if you're a really good parent at the 12 age and you're out of that relationship, they actually can carry that relationship throughout that phase because they've already developed a really good communication and way to work with the person.
Yeah.
Right? So that works for the 12-18. But if you're already in the phase of the 12-18 phase, it's kind of like at that point, it's their peer group. It's that if you have a really good friend, like the peer group, that kind of they can admire and work with and be with, that's really what's transformative. The parent is a little bit, what they say is you kind of want to do the opposite, you know. I don't know. I hope this breakdown is accurate. Okay, yeah, that's my experience too. And then to 18, 25, we're in college, we're kind of independent, we kind of do our own thing. And I usually find that usually we examine the relationship with our parents because we realize how much we're like our parents. In that age, we're like, whoa, I really like my father and my dad. This is scary. I never want to be like this, and I'm doing the same thing. I'm saying the same thing. I'm standing the same way. What's going on here? This is crazy. I deal with stress the same way. I mean, it's a little bit scary.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of moment where like, whoa, wait a moment. And then at past kind of college, like, depending on the after interaction with parents, I think some kids go completely off from their parents.
Mm-hmm.
They just, if their relationship wasn't very good, they just say, okay, my parents, they never understand me. I want to do my own thing, and so they cut it. Or they go back to their parents.
Yeah.
And there's a new, deeper relationship of, you know, they want to connect to my roots, my family, where I'm from. So I want to understand myself.
Right.
I mean, I saw a lot of Chinese people, I mean, Asian Americans, they go say Chinese, essentially from culture, because they want to connect with their roots.
Right.
And so that's kind of like the difference. Phases to a young person growing up in here in the West.
Yeah.
And I think for a parent, where you want to apply something in this age range, it depends on where they are. And in terms of Buddhism, I mean, I think, number one, Buddhism is probably not a religion, a philosophy. No, it's not a religion you want to like force a kid into doing.
Yeah.
That's not the spirit most kids will take it at. What you find is that I think the main thing, if you really want to influence a kid at these young ages, from 5 to 12, they're actually welcome learning. So, I mean, they will interact with parents. 12 to 18, pretty much, if a parent actually really takes Buddhism and practices it and transforms their fundamental habits,
mm-hmm.
I mean, this is really hard, because changing our fundamental habits and where we get angry and where we get impatient and being humble to like apologize to somebody or to to like be sincerely caring towards the kid in their own way, to listen to them deeply and not judge them and immediately react to what they say. If a parent actually doesn't really deeply cultivate in that way, it's almost impossible, I have to say, at that age. Because the only way that's going to impress a kid at that age is basically, you're going to have to be like super exemplar. Because like for me to believe that you're genuine, because my brain got all my hypocritical radars up, I got all my cynical radars up, and we're very cynical in America and for Western. So we see the kind of hypocrisy is very clearly for our parents, because we grew up with our parents. So we know where they have an ideal and where they don't need it. Mm-hmm. And you can read the rest over in there too, where they see their parents real and where they see it play a phony.
Yeah.
And so the only way, if you really want to include this, is you become real. And you become real in their world.
Very honest.
And so that actually transforms. I've seen a couple of that can actually transform a kid. Because they see that their parent, and then they become interested in Buddhism. They say, wow, my parents actually got transformed something. Maybe this is worth doing. Mm-hmm. But if it's something that's force-fed on them, mm-hmm. they usually go the other way faster than, you know, anything else that you can see.
Yeah, very good point.
So that's the second one. And the last thing that I just had before I could kind of finish is that if people want to talk about it, I also see that another area that I kind of have learned about over my years studying Buddhism was how kind of Western Asia culture can mutually support each other. Because there's a lot of places where there's some kind of conflict. The ideas around, I mean, we just talked about first asking questions. In Asia, a lot of times, there's an expectation of obedience, you know, following your parents. While in the West, it's very independent. So often there's a tension there, right? And so how do you resolve that? And so there's a couple ways to do that, and I won't go into that because I think I might just let people ask questions and whatever people want to talk about. But there's another thing since I've been living at the Sitting Down in Buddha, I've been in a very traditional Asian culture and trying to learn Buddhism, but I grew up here in America. I can kind of see where those kind of connections are, where maybe we can be supportive of each other, so that's another kind of topic. But yeah, I'm definitely just going to finish on that.
So David, you might want to tell the group how the City of 10,000 Buddha used to be very westernized, like a little bit of background about
quick real history. I mean, it started with Master Shenhua. I think people might not know. He came from China to bring Buddhism to America. So his initial disciples were actually all hippies in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, free love, you know. Mm-hmm. Smoking. So if you read those talks in the 60s and 70s, and those initial talks, they're all about like, you know, you should sleep around less. You should, you know, use a little bit less drugs. Like, you know. And it's like, with that's why when I said that the person who wrote this was Doug Powers, who actually came in as like a complete hippie. I mean, he had a huge transformation, where basically, most of the Westerners I met said they didn't expect him to live past like 35 because his life was so crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the very end, how he was transformed was he actually fell off a mountain. He actually like fell off a mountain and almost died. No, like he went to Malaysia on this trip, on a Dharma trip.
Yeah.
And then that, and he wanted to go. He's like, I'm so close to the Himalayas. I have to go climb the Himalayas. You know? And then that's why I was like, no, I mean, just wait for the trip to be over and then you go after that. He said, no, I have to go. Because the ice in that pass is going to melt and I'm not going to be able to go. And that's why I was like, no, it's fine. I promise you, the ice pass will be fine. He said, no, I have to. So at the end, he just goes.
He went.
And he goes in like sneakers and like an ice pick.
Oh, no.
And he goes like, he just goes to climb the Himalayas. It's like a really kind of spontaneous improv kind of person. And so he climbs with this other German guy he met. And he actually is climbing, and all of a sudden something below him, the ground like disappears, and he falls like 20, 30 feet.
Yay.
And he cracks his body, I think the man's like on his head, and he cracks his body in half.
Ooh.
He cracks his body like in half, where he has his body like cracked in half. Yeah. And he's actually like, so then the other guy's like, oh my goodness. So he crawls into like a cave, and the other guy goes like, looks for some help.
Wow.
And comes back like maybe a day or something, and he sets it in there, and they like helicopter him to Taiwan, and they decided to helicopter back to America, get a medical treatment.
Wow.
to bring him back, and then he gets, and so then he, so then he, and then he, and then, so then he came back to the monastery after like a 6 months or something. People were like, where did he go? And then he comes back, and he said that half his head face was actually like, I think called droopsy, but basically, so it looked kind of scary because half his face was like, had no muscle tension, so it just droop. The whole tap bite would just droop, so his face would look like kind of scary.
Not anymore.
He got a lot of surgery to fix it.
Wow.
And so he's doing really, you can actually see it if you actually look real careful. And so, they said, the turning point for him was that experience. And then he started listening to Master Hua a little bit more. And a lot of the Westerners, that was their experience, that Master Hua didn't actually force them to do something. He would tell them something, and then they wouldn't do it, and then they'd go through some massive suffering, and they'd go, wow, maybe I should learn a little bit more. And so in the early days, in Siddhanta Buddha, there were a lot more Westerners, and then in the 90s, I think a huge Taiwan contingent came, and Chinese contingent came, because
right.
In America, there's only like 30 or 40 disciples, but when Master Hua went to Asia and Taiwan, he had like thousands of people take refuge at once.
Yeah.
And so, like, just the proportionality of the people are really... And then also, what's really ironic is that in America, where he's seen as a really revolutionary a little bit, a kind of a liberal revolutionary, someone who's reformer, in Asia, people are attracted more like super conservative Asians. So then they ended up, I mean, right now, Siddhanta Buddha is mostly super conservative Asians. Kind of culture.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the general. But the thing that's really kind of interesting is because the senior leadership organization is actually all these kind of previous hippie Westerners.
Yeah.
So we got this kind of interesting dynamic where I feel fortunately part of it, I grew up here in America, being Asian American, so I can kind of understand the dynamic.
Both sides.
So where I end up, most of my work has been the last 5 years actually in communication, trying to communicate with the Western people, with the Asian people, with the different monastic and lay people, and all the different groups of people. So that's
very important.
Yeah. So you also the first semester you did some teaching.
Yeah, that was the first semester I did the class, which was basically I basically did it on when I was trying to introduce a Western religious thought to the community there. I thought that probably the best way is to go through the actual Bible itself. And so I have a chart if people are interested in that. Basically, if you go through the Bible, go through all the major religious concepts in the West, because usually when people think of religion in the West, they think Christianity. And most of the questions they bring to it are Christian questions. You know, what's the creation story? What's the creation story in Buddhism? I mean, for most Chinese people, they go, the creation story in Buddhism? There's a lot of humans here. There's this heaven. We were like a light heaven. We're in the light heaven. These gods came down and they ate these kind of the soil and the kind of vegetable, and then they got trapped on this planet. And the people read this. I don't know if people know that sutra. The sutta. There's a sutta in the Theravada that talks about that. But basically, I mean, that's one way you can respond to that question. Which for most Westerners, they go, uh huh. Okay, so we are from the heavenly realm, and then we came here, we ate food, and now we're trapped. Okay. Say another story would be, for instance, one of the disciples asking the Buddha those kind of questions, and the Buddha said the story of the poison arrow, which I think most of people might know, which is, you know, the person got shot by a poison arrow, and then the disciple asked the Buddha the question, you know, where the world came from, etc., and the Buddha basically said, it's like a person got shot by a poison arrow, and his people want to save him, but because he said, when he wanted to take it out and get him healed, he said, well, I want to know what kind of wood it is. I want to know what kind of poison it is. I want to know who shot me. I want to know his family. I want to know his clan. I want to know what his profession is. I want to know, you know, what the feather of that bird, of that, you know, what species. I mean, and before he answers all these questions, he's dead.
Yeah.
And so the Buddha says, I teach you what is useful.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a Westerner, I mean, so as I said, kind of passing answer, it's really pragmatic. So it's like, okay, I can take that. But you tell me we're from the heavens? Okay, that's a little bit strange. So what I did end up doing was going through the Christian Bible. We went through the creation story in the Bible, which was, God created the world and how the scientific world would be was in Genesis. And there's religious warfare in it. There's all these different things. So basically that was the idea.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first year.
Some more water?
Oh, okay, thank you. That makes well, that's warm.
So you brought a very good point. From age, pretty much from age zero, or say 2, 3, since they verbally can understand verbal language, 3 to 12 years old would be the good time.
That's the time where parents actually have some influence.
To plant the seed.
Yeah, that's the thing, you actually have influence. After that, it's a little bit risky.
So how do you coordinate that the age with the Buddhist teaching, that the Buddhist idea that you try to work on
just in what part of Buddhism's teaching would be used for each age group?
No, I mean, what kind of plane that 10,000 Buddha Lanes or what the program that you evolved to help that age of
the before 12?
The group of the age of the kids.
From which age?
Before 12. Yeah.
There is an elementary school there. I have to say that it's being developed. To be real honest, our community is really Asian.
Yeah.
And they generally still use very Asian methodology, which is you just follow what I say.
Yeah. Oh, summer program?
For which one?
Summer program.
Which one?
Summer camp.
They have a summer camp. They have a summer camp that's definitely, that basically teaches them, say, some kind of Chinese culture, some kind of virtue studies or something. And it's done in a good way. I mean, we're improving. In this era, we're definitely improving. When I first got there to now, we've improved a great deal in terms of actually teaching in a way that actually connects with modern people, modern young people. We have a long way to improve it. And I don't think we have any kind of standard good way to approach it. I have ideas myself.
Okay.
And they're right now working on a curriculum to actually develop a way to teach Buddhism to all these different age groups from kindergarten to 12th grade. But that's a current ongoing project.
I see.
That,
we
that
also
thing
have
done.
Someone in charge of developing
curriculum.
Program for like college kids, right? Remember?
You mean like safety?
We're
going to really start this year, have a lot of more events for the 18 to 25 year old range.
Oh, 18 to 25.
Before that, there's the schools there. They have summer camp over the summertime. But this is a work in progress. I mean, I can think of a lot of things. We won't go into it, that's a long topic. But there's a lot. I think there's a lot of things that range can benefit from for
right.
sure.
Right.
In Buddhism.
Can I ask you a few questions if you don't mind?
Yeah.
Personal?
Okay.
Sharing your personal
okay.
with us, is that okay?
My personal. Okay.
Maybe starting by, can I ask you, when did you feel this closeness of attraction
to Buddhism? Were you here in the very beginning? We came a little bit.
I'm sorry if I come in there to make it that way.
So I can add a little bit to it.
Then you can talk about things you didn't talk about and how we were going.
Well, I mentioned I was for sure in the Buddhist class here at Mount Buddhist Society, and I got interested in high school. And I went to college, and I mean, I think the fundamental attraction to Buddhism for me, and my own kind of personal story, was I thought it was a really... It wasn't so much Buddhism. I was looking for a kind of purpose in life that was meaningful, that made sense. Because as a young person, you kind of look out in society and I go, well, is that it? I look at my parents and I look at my parents' friends and my friends' parents. I'm like, do I want to be like that? I mean, real. I'm like, how many people are really deeply happy? I mean. I don't know. And so, I mean, that started kind of the interest in looking into something that was a little bit deeper. Because my feeling was at the time was generally things were very kind of a superficial level of happiness. People go to parties and you say the same things and you put on this kind of show of being happy and being like everything being very successful. Especially in this area, which everybody's really successful. These are the successful people of society and they go on show of being successful. And they go back home and things are like falling apart. And like some of the kids are going through like suffering. And the parents are also going through suffering. And I'm like, huh. So that was the thing that I thought, where does it all lead? Where's it all going? So I started looking for some kind of purpose, some kind of meaning. And that was actually, I found it very interesting because given what I was talking before about those different viewpoints, people, when I started asking those kind of questions, thought, well, are you kind of depressed? And I was like, no, I'm not even interested in that question. Because the response, like, something I got was, I mean, some of the parents told me even, when I asked them, because I asked a lot of people about this, I was like, I looked and I found nothing.
Yeah.
Don't waste your time.
Yeah.
I got the message from a couple of people. I mean, I being independent, I was like, I don't believe you. I think there's something somewhere. But I have to say, that's the general feeling. And that was when I was in high school, which kind of was the thing. And then I went to college, and I felt very happy because I found a young adult group of people interested in spirituality, not even Buddhism per se, but like spiritual practice, like really trying to practice. And then we seemed to have an affinity with each other, and over the years I just did that. and I live in the monastery now. So my reality, I have to say, I'm not 100% connected with this generation this last 5 years because I've been living in the monastery. I know bits and pieces. You know, I recently got a Facebook page, and it's blocked. Even the Facebook page is blocked at CBD, so I don't check Facebook. But basically, I mean, I don't really actually connected with this. I can talk to most of the young people year 2000 and before. I know the music, I know the video games, I know the movies and what's going on. But past that, I'm kind of out of date. Mm-hmm. Although I can learn from, I usually just kind of learn with their experiences. I try to, but I have to say, my assessment, I looked at the stuff, it's gotten a lot worse. Because the TV shows I kind of watch, sometimes I watch my brother, I'm like, wow, this is really bad now. Make no sense. When I was in high school, we watched a lot of TV. Those TV shows were actually somewhat like interesting and like actually were like funny, but actually a little bit wholesome at the same time.
Yeah, content. Right now, it's
now with no content. Now it's just kind of really not content. There's no real content. It's just kind of distraction, excitement, kind of. Even I would say, in terms of advertising, I realized 2.5 years. Last 2.5 years, the advertising actually has come to be outright lying, which is amazing to me. I mean, I look at the characters are advertising to be healthy, and like he's feeling like wow. And I talk to my friends like, yeah, the 2.5 years ago, the FDA actually loosened their actual advertising requirements. What's scary about it is not that actually that they're doing that, but that they're doing that only because it's effective. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure they've done their research and that's effective. So I'm like, whoa, that's even scarier that people read it and they believe it.
Right.
that's the current young adult. So I don't know. So my life is a little bit distanced from that, but I feel connected enough that I've gone through that experience. And I can kind of, I think it's just getting tougher year by year, actually, my feeling is. And that the Dharma becomes, I mean, more and more appealing. As things get worse and worse, and it's more and more, the kind of facade of society gets more and more, like, thin, and everything is really virtual, people want to look for something real. And so that's why I think the Dharma is really, really helpful. That's why I feel really, it's a very meaningful thing to study, because I think at this ultimate level, this is really what will help people. I'm not worried that people go through suffering. I mean, suffering is a part of life, we know. But that there's actually an ultimate solution to that. It's not you just get fed or something, you get a girlfriend and now you're happier, and you find a wife and now you're really happy. There's a deeper solution that the Buddha gave that addresses suffering at a very deep level. And that's what the arms of Buddhism actually presents. And the young people actually, I think, that they understood it in their own language, like, wow, this is awesome. And this really would help me find some direction in my life to actually know what I'm doing. You know, because it's not true, it doesn't rely on a God, for it's like a precept, and the precepts, the different way to explain the precepts in Buddhism, the Jiedu, right? Mm-hmm. People could say it's really dogmatic, like, you know, all these rules, what have you. But the precepts actually in Buddhism mean freedom. And the Pratimoksha, the word Pratimoksha actually means freedom in Buddhism. So the way that actually precepts are freedom is a new concept, where if you don't kill, you don't steal, you don't lie, you don't sexual misconduct, you don't get intoxicants, it actually doesn't cause you to create karma where you're tied up and not free. I mean, you read these things, I would say, because they're in these real confusing relationships, they're tied up. They don't realize how much freedom of space in your own mind that you can have. If you have really good friends around, really good people around all the time, that you can be in an environment where you trust everybody.
Yeah, in Taoism it says freedom explained in the choose your own limits. You gotta choose your own limits, and that's true freedom. And so the precept is the limits that we're willing to choose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
I have a question. How do you handle expectations? Because you're a very typical kid of the first generation Chinese.
Yeah.
And then you're being expected. Your parents are expecting you.
Yeah.
So how do you go through the process?
That's my parents. That's my parents. They're going to be very interested.
I wanted to ask this question from both sides, because you're being expected. And the other side is expecting you. And how do you reconcile this process?
Okay, well, I have to say that it was definitely a long process, and I had to grow myself a lot, and she has my own, you know, confusions. And I think my parents also, I don't know, I think they also grew a lot in the process. Because I think I'm a little bit extreme. I mean, so most parents, you know, they care for their kids are like a, I mean, doctor, engineer, lawyer, something. And I'm off in the monastery. And that's like completely off the actual Richter chart. I mean, that's not even on the like 5-year plan of being like a successful, actually stable, independent, you know, successful young man in society. I mean, doesn't have any of the markers of that. And so I have to say I had a lot of talks with my parents, both my mom and my dad, about, but because I felt this was meaningful, I had to kind of really talk, we had to communicate. I mean, I learned a lot from kind of these kind of talks about how should I interact with my parents. Because, you know, part of me could say, forget my parents, they don't understand what I'm doing. Because they're in a materialistic mind frame. I mean, that's, I mean, so really, I mean, materialistic, they're looking to the society standards, the economic way of being. I'm actually pursuing a spiritual path, which is much higher principles. And my life is based on that, they don't understand it. So, don't, that's why I'm bothering with them. And that's one way to approach it. And that's one thought in my mind, like, oh, I don't know, that's a good way to go about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and then there's a way, you know, like, okay, so do I really want to make them happy? Now, I don't think I can do that. Deep down, I think this is where I'm supposed to be, what I'm supposed to be doing. And so I couldn't just do that either. So it started a long process of communication. I mean, I think what I realized at one point was also it was really difficult for my parents because where before I was a somewhat successful kid growing up all the way through high school, even going through college, all of a sudden I became like a non-starter topic. Because like, what do you want? Why are you letting your kid do that? You know, I get good feelings, like, your kid's in his own world. I mean, I wouldn't let my kid do that. I mean, that's crazy. So I would say my parents all around her too, from their peer groups. And so yeah, I mean, it was a both way. And so on my side, I think what I learned, I mean, what I realized at one point, I came back home and I basically was so inspired by Buddhism, I was like trying to be like a monastic at home. I'd meditate, I'd recite, I'd vow, you know, I'd do my practices, and then my dad would call my mom to really, my parents really afflicted. So I'm like, not doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm not talking to my friends, socializing, not going out and like finding a job and getting internships and like, you know, doing things I'm supposed to be doing in terms of being a kid. And so, at one point though, one of those kind of moments of turning was actually when I was talking to one of the senior monks at Western. The Asian monk actually didn't quite understand the dynamic, but the Western actually understood it a little bit. And, cause they just said, oh, just leave home. I mean, just, you know, they're just like, oh, this is normal. Parents don't. And so, I mean, their actual suggestions were more in the Chinese tradition of, you know, when you leave home, you just leave home. I mean, you just kind of drop everything. And your parents are just, you know, they're attachments and they're kind of fettered. Well, in the West, it was a little bit different. And I remember kind of being scolded saying, you should listen to your mom more. Like, fuck. Like, really? Okay. I mean, and so at that point, I kind of changed my focus from being trying to be a monk in my own individualistic way of trying to think about how I thought that was supposed to be done, to saying, put that energy into learning how to be a good son. And that became much more effective. That was maybe 2003. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't. 2003. 2003. Around there. So 2003, I said, okay, maybe I should do this. I mean, before that, it was like complete tension all the time. I mean, yeah. It was like, oh my goodness, I was very scared of talking. And then, so I thought, okay, so what should I do? And so basically try to be a good son. And I try to say, okay, so, you know, where could I help? Where could I be, you know, where could I help his family? Where could I be a good kid? And then rather than focusing my time on just meditating, I would actually try to put my energy in listening carefully and changing myself to be a good kid. And I think that was kind of in time when I became less headstrong, you know, mm-hmm. that I realized that I'm supposed to kind of connect with my parents and understand what that relationship is. Mm-hmm. And I think I found a kind of deep source of gratitude that I didn't know existed, mm-hmm. which I think is the actual spring of the religious, the spiritual quest. Mm-hmm. If you actually look at all the great masters of Asia, they all have this really deep connection with their parents. Shun Lao Song, mean, Venerable Master Hua, I mean, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Mun, they all had really deep connection with their parents in terms of a gratitude towards them for what they gave. And that's something I think is a kind of wellspring of kind of, it kind of warms the heart, almost as the whole part of your body kind of warms up when you actually have that experience. For a lot of kids who don't have it, actually dry. So I didn't know ever knew before. But it's actually really a kind of a physical and mental experience of actually a warming up of a piece of your actual spiritual psyche almost. And I think the other piece of that was that you also begin to see all the small things that parents do for you. That's what my parents are like. But basically, when you're actually a kid, actually, because they're trained to look into like all the negative things oftentimes, that they don't actually, if you actually paid attention to all the small ways that parents do try their best to help out or care for you, you go, wow, they do a lot. You know, that every moment of the day, what they're trying to do, what they're trying to, and what they're talking to you, and what they're trying, if you actually can listen to them and see them from their actual life, you actually kind of get a sense of it. So that's where the gratitude, the source of that comes from. And then it's not a force of trying to like, I'm trying to be, it's like, wow, I really want to be this. I mean, this is just a natural relationship. And then it's still 2-3 years with work. And then I went to Siddhananda Buddha's, which was another moment when I actually decided after college to like go and live in the kind of temple Buddhist community environment. And then being over there the last 5 years, I mean, I think I learned a lot. And I came home and I always try to communicate what I'm thinking or what I'm doing with my parents and have that communication channel open. I have to say, if there was anything I could do that was helpful to my parents that they told me to do, I tried my best to do what they said and learn the humility of that. But if it was around that, I think it was really important, that was my direction in life, which is, you know, going through this kind of stuff, I actually couldn't compromise on that piece. And I was really clear about that. That's just my kind of path. But all this time, I'm trying my best to try to go with that. So that was a kind of a long process. And I think it's been a long process that we're actually at this moment in this room talking about this topic. So, and my mom not being happy. And my dad being, I think, relatively happy.
But I think the difference is, I think over the last, I think you started like 1999 till now, over the 10, 11 years, period. I saw a lot of, you know, people passed away, you know, and sufferings. And also, I think I have studied, you know, I have been doing a lot of Buddhism studies as well. And so I think it's a gradual process.
Yeah, for sure.
But I do have to say I have mixed feelings.
Yeah.
But it's very admirable to see that you're making the choice while your parents are still supporting you.
Yeah.
And then I can see a very happy family.
Yeah, the gratitude there.
Right.
Yeah. Do our part. I mean, every they say in the Buddhism that every family has their sutra. Yeah.
But it's such an honor and really beautiful thing to see family can sit here and talk so honestly and openly. That's very sweet. It's very nice, yeah.
Yeah.
I do want to say thanks to this group. I mean, this group is really, that's where you started, right?
Yeah, I started here. And we're still here. Still studying. I think Buddhism has a lot to benefit the world. I mean, I have to say, for parents as well, I mean, a lot of parents at this age, you know, are running off. I mean, a lot of my parents' friends are, like, running off. Like, the men are running off with younger women. Like, their age.
You know, what's going on?
What's going on? I mean, there's no actual, I mean, the reason is because they want to, if you actually have the phases of life, you're actually going and trying to, like, reclaim your childhood, and you kind of have all this, and then, but there's no actual context. They have no actual Buddhist kind of principle and kind of way to hold in their desire or something. And practice to actually form it, so they get kind of just moved by society, you know, and that causes a lot of suffering. I mean, there's a lot of suffering. I mean, and I can see a lot of these things where Buddhism actually provides a kind of foundation to your life where you have a freedom to actually do a lot of stuff. It seems really boring, but it's not boring. I mean, living in a temple, you know, it's not boring at all. I mean, I wouldn't trade my experience with the other people's in many ways. They probably wouldn't trade it with me either.
What are you doing? You're the last summer.
Everything's relative.
Everything's relative. Relativism, there you go.
Because it's my experience, like I remember went to City of 10,000 Buddha for the Guanyin Qi. I think it's interesting, like you went there and people there looking at the outside world as they are abnormal, and then you come out and the people look, they CCTV, like they are abnormal. Yeah. So you know, it's
who see too, huh? I'm a beholder. Yeah.
It's just it's a learning process.
Yeah, it's a learning process. I mean, I think that what Buddhism offers is a kind of a deep reflection on life to be able to, I mean, till on the parent side, I think parent would talk better, but I think that to look at the actual expectations that are laid on the kid, I mean, to see actually what their process actually is and listen to what they're actually going through, because it's not as easy, it's not as simple as they growing up in Asia. I mean, that's one of the things I think is really important, is that growing up here in America is not so much growing up in Asia, where a lot of parents didn't need to spend all the way. I found that a lot of parents didn't actually spend, my parents didn't spend a lot of time with their parents, actually. They would go off to Bushidan, all these things. But the thing was that they didn't need it because the society reinforced all their values. All they were focused on going to college. So, but here in America, it's way more complicated. They're trying to navigate through, should I use drugs? Should I have this intimate relationship? Should I get into this intimate relationship? You know, and they're dealing with all these different emotions and things and questions. And even the hierarchy isn't, say, go to college as the actual, I mean, in at least in elementary school, throughout, I was actually really teased a lot. I mean, being intelligent is actually somewhat nerdy and looked down upon in a Western society where athleticism is actually something that's really admired in this kind of peer, in our range of peer groups of that grade.
Right.
So that structure is also very different. So the whole, I mean, to push a kind of academic as the only standard already is a completely, a complete disconnect for kids. So one of the kids' experiences is I had to put up a face for my parents. Just like just get through the day with them, and I do my own life.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
And the parents never know. It's like they penetrate this,
right.
And I just kind of okay, I can say a couple things. Okay, I can make my room, do my stuff. I mean, so that they put up like a, and they don't want to do that. I mean, a lot of kids in the thing you see that I live this fake life for my parents. I don't like doing that, but that's what they do, and that's what we do. So that's the key,
wow.
Right?
Yeah. Just back to maybe this question a little bit, I hope you don't mind, a little bit personal, but maybe I missed a point here. Because when you mentioned that you sort of determined you want to become a monk, and that you said first you
yeah.
Be a good son.
Yeah, you're a good son.
And start to appreciate your parents in the various ways. But wouldn't that make you more attached
to my parents?
Yes.
Not if you do it with wisdom.
Oh.
I mean, I'm not, I have to say, I'm not going at it from a perspective of attaching to their expectations and attaching to them as a sense of identity for myself. I'm going at it from a sense of I'm cultivating, understanding myself, listening to them carefully, looking at myself carefully to see how I react to what they say to me. How I can better myself and change myself, and where I can develop a gratitude towards them. And a gratitude, it's not like an emotional love, like emotional stickiness to the thing. I'm trying to get something for my parents. You know, I'm not like, I do this and my parents can do this for me. That's not the unconditional care and the compassion that Buddhism teaches. Right? That's the kind of the worldly way of reciprocity of a relationship. So yeah, I think there's that. I mean, what I found was that the relationship has deepened. What I found is it deepens, and it stays genuine. That's the thing. And it could get sticky. I mean, you read some kids, they want their parents' attention or something, and they base their life around what their parents are trying to expect from them. There's like this internal pressure or something. I guess I don't feel that. My parents probably can vouch for that. My mom always says, "You're too independent." When I said it doesn't really matter, it does. I try to, I listen to it and I think about it. But I definitely feel like there's a kind of a path. Yeah.
David, I have a question. So far I've noticed that most Western teachers seem to teach Dharma in bits and pieces instead of teaching it systematic. Is it because the people want to personalize Dharma to their way of living? But because compared to Christianity, for example, they have a value system, how to behave in that peace system. And what I want to ask is truthful, why is that the Buddhist is also a philosophy, but I don't hear that being taught to Westerners often as a systematic.
As a systematic structure?
Yeah.
I would say my reason I feel that way is because Buddhism is very new to America. Well, say Christianity has been in America thousands of years. I mean, in the West, America is a new country, but in the West, it's really deep. I mean, so Buddhism does have systems of thought that are actually developed around Asian. For instance, my dad keeps wanting me to read a Buddhahood as a kind of introductory Buddhist text. It's a really good Buddhist interpretation. I don't think that's a really good way to introduce a Westerner to Buddhism. That wouldn't be the system I would use to introduce somebody to Buddhism. For instance, one way to introduce it would be, say, going through the Bible. I would actually read passages of the Bible, and from there, I actually systematically explain all those concepts, how this relates to Buddhism. Give them a systematic way to understand Buddhism from their actual experience of their life, growing up in America, American. Or there's a lot of professors who wrote the Intro to Buddhism books. Some are not 100% right, but if you have a sense of Buddhism, you can correct those. But they also present Buddhism in a systematic way that is helpful for a Western mind, because they speak and write for a Western mind. They can call on Greek philosophers, you know, Plato, Aristotle, Nietzsche, Jesus Christ. I mean, they pull on those narratives and those structures of thinking, which is a Westerner, they think about it. Right now, I mean, that's one major project that I also work in the university, at the same time, right now a major project is how to take this Asian body of knowledge, not just translate it word for word, but translate its systems of thought so the Western person can systematically understand the Dharma in a deep level. Because right now it's very superficial. Right now it's just basically popular books you get off the shelf. You said bits and pieces, bits and pieces, bits and pieces. There's no systematic way to actually, and the people who are interested in that have no real doorway into it. Yeah. But there's interest. I mean, there's interest for sure.
The other related question about the values, or for example, how to approach a particular issue. So this seems also to be a new challenge, because Buddhism has been closely tied to Asian culture.
Yeah.
And how can you have a Western society with Western values, how do you reconcile that?
That's a big area. And we're in the process right now. I mean, right now, Buddhism's in that process right now. Unless you have a pretty good question about it, I won't talk about that, because that'd be another hour and a half talking about Buddhism in the West.
But I have to say, when he first started learning Buddhism, I think he went to the Dharma youth group. Like,
which one?
The first one you came back, you
were so, CDB?
Yeah,
or
so,
here?
So excited about CDB,
yeah.
I think they taught about the
filial respect.
Filial respect. And that's something you never
thought about. Yeah.
But then I think the next year, you know, I decided to just go to check things out. Because I was concerned. I wanted to see what he's been hearing.
So join a cult.
No, I know CDTB has a good reputation, you know, so I know it's good. But I just want to find out how is he so attractive to the teaching. And I was amazed, actually. I saw all the Westerners, you know, the disciples of late Master Huang, talking to a group of all the Asian kids, like David, about Buddhism in English.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something really made me think about, you know. And I found myself, I was, you know, listening to their talk. I was very much interested, you know, because I think in a way, because for us, we've been here long enough, sometimes the more traditional Asian way doesn't always connect our minds. I think
their experience.
Our experience, yeah. Okay. Although I think there's merit to the sutra, the fundamental things. But I think for this generation of kids, they cannot learn, although that's your goal, is trying to learn Chinese.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be learning a lot of Chinese pretty soon.
Mm-hmm. But you cannot read the sutra either.
I can't really read yet. I can read some of the basic Buddhist texts, but not very deeply. Very slowly.
So what's your next project?
I'm actually thinking of really entering into the monastic tradition. So that's going to be the next step.
How do you see yourself 5 years from now?
Probably as a monastic. I hope that the monks accept me.
I'd
go through the training. I'm actually thinking of starting in mid-June. During the monastery. June.
So, traditionally, how long does it take for them to...
Tradition in terms of Buddhism or tradition in terms of...
I mean,
traditionally, Buddha... If you don't say Buddhism, the Buddha was like immediate. Bhikkhu, okay? Bhikkhu. Just come.
Bhikkhu.
Yeah, come. Mm-hmm. And you're a monk.
Oh.
I mean, that was in the very beginning. And they all became like arhats, like very good, like they became arhats. But over the centuries, people got, during the Buddha's life, people get less and less spiritually accomplished, and they broke a lot of rules. And so they created all these precepts, and they created a process of ordination. But for at least Siddhant Buddha, there's a kind of a training period where you do your ordination. So, like, it ranges from, 3 to 5 years.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah.
Will there be a ceremony?
Yeah, probably mid-June. It's going to start off. It's the first time to take a Bhagwan's idea as a layperson for 6 months. And then the plan is they do the 10 precepts, the Shami precepts, for the 10 precepts. And that will be probably in the process in December. And then next will be 2 to 5 years, depending on their next ordination and the person's readiness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's a process. So we'll see. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Mm-hmm.
Big decision.
Yeah. Very different life. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting.
When you look back to your M20 religion,
mm-hmm.
That is your religious studies.
Religious studies, yeah.
Does it help your spiritual practice in any way?
My spiritual practice in any way. I have to say, I can say yes. Okay, I was going to say not really, but I think there's areas where it does, if you include the spiritual practice as being able to communicate with people. The field of religious studies is a kind of an academic scholarly study of religion, where you oftentimes use like sociology, anthropology, I can never say that it's called hermeneutics or something. Hermeneutics. And then philology. I'm sorry about my pronunciation. But basically, those are different methods that the West has developed to understand and be critical of religion. To understand religion. Not critical in the negative, but critical to understand religion, to study it. And it's useful because you can get a broad understanding of the actual religious tradition. It's very interesting. And in terms of the actual spiritual practice, in terms of my actual cultivation, it doesn't quite connect in terms of, and it's not like spiritual teaching. It's kind of like a method of inquiry into a discipline. So where I see it useful is that I communicate within that framework to talk to other people of those backgrounds. And also it's useful because oftentimes people are curious about different religions, especially when it comes to Buddhism or different things, to understand different religious traditions. It gives people the context to understand what we're doing. So history, understanding history is actually very valuable. First, you can understand the Christian history. That to come to the point now where people believe the way they believe is a historical process. The Christians believe different things at different times. You look at historical periods. Same as Buddhists believe different things at different times. So you also get out of your narrow view of like, this is the only way, this is the only time. I mean, there's like kind of you see the historical, a larger picture. So maybe that's another element. Okay. Well, questions out.